Okay, so let's see what. There's quite a lot of questions tonight, so let's see how we go. Okay, dear Asan Brahmali, I have no fear when doing the death contemplation. In fact, there was a sense of peace when I finally die, but I have a lot of worries over my health. Any kind of illness tends to worry me. So how do I contemplate illnesses? I need to learn this to overcome my worries over ill health. Thank you for your wonderful and insightful teachings. The suttas were well chosen. Okay, good. Well, in a sense, you know, just by contemplating death, you are already dealing with your ill health in one sense, because if you are at ease with dying, and dying is easy, then the health issues become less of a problem, right? Because they are kind of part of the same scheme of things. So if you can do the death contemplation and be at ease with that, that will probably be a great help in resolving some of those problems of ill health. Generally speaking, you know, when it comes to ill health, you can only do so much. And sometimes you just have to accept that there's limits to what you can do. You do all the right things, you go to the doctor, you eat the right things, you get the right amount of exercise, and you do whatever is necessary. Do a bit of meditation. I think if you calm yourself down and you have less worries and you feel good, I think that's probably good for the body as well. So do all of those things. And then the rest, whatever happens beyond that, is outside of your control. Maybe it's karma, who knows what it is, it's very hard to know. But you just have to say, okay, this is the way it is, I'm going to deal with that. And if you can, as you say, if what you're saying here is correct, that the death contemplation is fine, then I don't think you have too much to worry about, because that means that you are, you know, if you, illness is not going to be too much of a problem for you. Okay, so let's see what you can do and see how things go. Okay, next one then. What else did you ask Ajahn Kanha? What are the biggest changes you can see in yourself after being a monk for 20 years? Okay, what else did I ask Ajahn Kanha when I met him? This was this Thai monk I went to visit in Thailand a couple of months ago. I didn't really ask all that much. I asked him, what did I ask him? I asked him, what can I do to support Ajahn Brahm? That's one of the questions I asked him. He said, make sure he looks after his health. It's very hard to make sure Ajahn Brahm looks after his health. He has his own ideas about that. So that's kind of some simple things I asked him. And the biggest changes you can see in your life after being a monk for 20 years, well, it's just change. It's very gradual, right? It happens very slowly here. So this is just this gradual movement towards more contentment and peace and happiness and less kind of suffering in life, you know. So all of these things is gradually growing, and the negative qualities kind of disappearing here. I think one of the big changes is the fact that you are able to deal with things like death, it seems, quite easily. You know, sometimes you have friends or people who... I can see that in some of my friends. One of my friends had some very kind of serious tragedies in his family. Two people died for suicide and that sort of thing. And he was very distraught by that. But I told him just a couple of simple things, you know, which I've basically taken from Buddhist ideas. And that was already very, very helpful for him. Most people don't get this kind of advice. They're not aware of this kind of advice. Usually the advice they get can be very, very ill-chosen and bad, you know. When it comes to suicide, how do you comfort somebody who has family members committing suicide? You have to, you know, first of all, not create any guilt feeling, obviously. And sometimes even say, in most of society, suicide is considered very bad. But is it necessarily bad? Sometimes it isn't bad, right? Sometimes you're in a difficult situation, and sometimes maybe it is okay. It really depends on your character beforehand and so many factors. You can't really judge somebody for committing suicide. Once you look at it in the right way, it doesn't look so bad anymore. It's nobody's fault, and maybe it was a good thing. Maybe the outcome was a positive one. Who knows? It's very hard to say. Simple things like that, you know, and it's remarkable. You can sometimes be very effective in that way. Also, in regard to your family members, right? They after a while, they start to respect what you're doing, and they ask you questions about these things, and they say, wow, this is really good stuff, and they listen to your talks on YouTube, and they read Buddhist books and all this kind of things. So it's really, you can see that it has an effect, you know. When you change, other people kind of notice that, and they see what's going on there. Trying to tell others through teachings is often not the best way. The best way is often to be an example, and that example carries much more weight than any teaching almost. Okay. Dear Ajahn Brahmani, have I got it right? According to dependent origination, I suffer because I am deluded. In order to not suffer, I have to undelude myself by hanging out with Ajahn Brahm and by reading the suttas. This will condition me to be a kind and virtuous person who will feel no regret, joy, etc. And then my mind will skip into jhanas and see clearly. I will then be an undeluded so I can abandon craving and be free from rebirth. So simple, but so hard to do. Okay. That's right. That's basically it. You basically got it, right? But, you know, it sounds, as you say, it sounds easy on paper, but then in the reality is often more complicated. It's not really hard to do, right? It's just that it takes the most difficult things in Buddhism is not understanding what you have to do or even it being very hard. It's just being committed and, you know, having the perseverance and the kind of keeping going long enough for these things actually to happen. That is really the hard part, right? That commitment, that perseverance, keep going. Sometimes it looks like you're stagnating. And then when it looks like you're stagnating, you have to really investigate why that is. And if you keep on investigating, you should be able to find the answer. There would be an answer there. There's a reason why things aren't moving forward anymore. And so it's this commitment that is often the hardest thing. When you look at other people have been practicing for a long time, or you look at your own progress sometimes, it gives you a sense of, yes, this can be done, right? And this is one of those things that it's so important to have that sense that these things can be done, that other people have done it before you. And that's why the arahants of the world and the Aryas and people who are getting results, they can be so inspiring to us, because if they can do it, you can do it, right? Never think that you are different. You're not any worse. You're just a human being like everybody else. If other people can do it, you can do it. Everybody can do it. Also, don't think you're better. Don't think that, yeah, they are just arahants. I will become a Buddha, right? That's much better. So they can. Don't kind of get into that thing either. So just get into, yeah, we're all human beings. We're all conditioned. We're all in the same situation. I can do it. They can do it. We can all do it. As I said before, if you have a mind, then you can do it. So you have no excuses. Only if you don't have a mind, then you have an excuse. So let me know. If anybody here hasn't got a mind, let me know, and we'll see what we can do. Okay. Dear Ajahn, this is the resentment, about the resentment sutta, removing resentment. What is the meaning of the opening of the mind, placidity of the mind? Okay, so that is basically the kind of mind state where you have no hindrances, right? When the mind is clear, the Pali word is vivarana citta, the opposite of nivarana. And vivarana means an open mind where there is no hindrances blocking you. No blockages, right? It means openness instead. So it is a mind which is peaceful, beautiful, which has all these good qualities in it. That's really what it means. Placidity of the mind. Mind is calm, placid, even, like a placid lake. A lake where the surface is completely like a mirror surface, right, on the lake. Your mind is like that. Yeah? Okay. Dear Ajahn Brahmani, I have read some books by Ajahn Sumedho, and he often talks about using the awareness of the sound of silence in meditation. Are you familiar with this? Can you make any comment about it with metta? The sound of silence, yes, that's one of his ideas. I think he has got that from some kind of Mahayana Buddhist technique or something like that. I don't think it's found in Theravada Buddhism as such. It is basically just a simple thing to be aware of, to kind of simplify things and to be aware of things. And the sound of silence is supposed to be just a very faint sound that you can always hear. When you become peaceful, you can hear the sound of blood blood in your ear or something like that. That's apparently the sound of silence. So it's kind of this very regular, faint silence and sound, and you can focus on that to make you at least relatively peaceful. So if that's something you want to do, you can try that, see if it works. I wouldn't really necessarily recommend it. It's not something found in the suttas. The Buddha doesn't talk about it. The Buddha talks about just using the breath. Eventually, you have to go beyond all sound anyway, right? Sound ultimately is a disturbance, whether it is a sound of silence or any other sound. You want to go beyond that. That's where the real samadhi actually happens. But as a kind of medium stage on the path, maybe it can be used. If it works for you, try it out and see what happens. Okay. Dear Venerable Mali, could you please explain a little about metta practice to jhana level? Is the feeling of metta taken as the object of one-pointedness? And is it a feeling nimitta? And is the experience after a metta-jhana different from the usual pitti-sukha of peace, etc.? Very much better. Thank you for the guided meditation on death. It was great. Okay, good. The idea of metta-meditation is that you eventually just focus on the feelings, right? As you say, the feeling is taken as the object itself. So initially you may start off with people, you may start off with visualizing certain directions or visualizing the whole world or whatever it is. But eventually it is just the feeling itself that remains. And as with so many things in meditation practice, positive feelings, they can often turn themselves into nimittas, the bright lights and that sort of thing. So these things can happen with any kind of meditation object. It really depends on how the feeling is going. If the feeling is becoming very powerful, it can take you to that stage. And of course, once you have this nimitta there, the bright light or the sun or whatever you want to call it, then of course you can use that to take you into jhana itself. Via that nimitta, you will then move on into the jhana experience. So it's really the same kind of idea, the same kind of path. The hardest part is just to get the feelings going to begin with, as often, people can often find that difficult. But then once you have them going, you have something you can work with, and then gradually develop them more and more powerfully. Hopefully every year, you find that when you go on retreat, you have a little bit more power in your metta meditation because you've been doing all the right things in between. Yes, take the feeling as the object after you feel that it's kind of a strong feeling is there. Take it to the nimitta and then you use that to kind of enter a jhana after that. All you really have to do is to stay there and stay with things, right? You don't have to do anything very much. This is the wonderful thing about meditation practice. There's nothing to do. You just sit back and you are aware, right? And things develop all by themselves. It's such a wonderful, easy thing to do. The simplest thing in the world. And yet somehow we tend to complicate it. Sit back, wait, and it develops all by itself. And that is really the way into jhana. It's the way that, certainly the way Ajahn Brahm would teach it. Is the experience after jhana the same? If you go into metta and you have a usual one, is it the same feeling? It would be similar, right? A similar kind of feeling because it is based on the jhana experience. But I think I'm not 100% sure about this, but I think perhaps the fact that you are using metta when you enter the jhana will have a residual effect afterwards. Because you use that as an object, it means that the mind will be slightly more pure. It will take longer before anger and negativity arises again afterwards, because you have purified the mind through the metta practice. So in that way, it's very powerful and very useful. And it can maybe add a little bit more oomph than just the ordinary jhanas. I mean, ordinary jhanas, that's kind of a ridiculous ridiculous statement, but you know what I mean, not just the jhanas. The jhanas are the uttarimanusarama, they are the superhuman state, the allang arya nanadasana visaya, so the distinction in knowledge of vision worthy of the Aryans. It's the sambodha sukha, the happiness awakening, the footsteps of the Buddha, they're kind of... In the suttas, the jhanas and the four stages of awakening, and sometimes the brahmaviharas, they're kind of put in a separate category here, and they have very similar qualities, so they're very high states of mind. Okay. Dear Ajahn, we are overfed with a variety of food. We normally at home don't consume, even in a week, here in a day. Okay. I see her. Okay. Shall we pay respect to all the donors of those foods and give merits for the dana? That's a very good idea. Above all, shall we say three sadhus to Bianca, who manages the whole retreat and look after all of us. We know she starts her day around 4:30 a.m. and finishes late in the night. May she attain nibbana in this very life. Okay, that's very kind of you. So sadhu, sadhu, sadhu for that. Yes, indeed, it's important to, it's actually quite nice to remember all the support you get here, all the people who come and offer dana, and Bianca, and all the people who are volunteers and who work out. There's so many people who do a lot of good work, so what a wonderful thing that is. Basically, the Buddhist Society runs on that basis, so it's really great. And also one of the things that is good, very useful for this Buddhist Society, because Ajahn Brahm has a very strong international following, it means that a lot of donations and things that have helped to build Jhana Grove has also come from overseas. So it's a large community that has pitched in to make this possible. So it's a wonderful, wonderful thing indeed. So well said. Okay. Dear Ajahn, I have read about the four nutriments, but cannot remember well. My impression is that the Buddha taught that food is just food. It is essential for survival, so we shouldn't should not think too much about it. The simile is the couple have to eat their only baby. That's exactly right. He just said moderate eating. As for the three nutriments, sense, pleasure, volition, and consciousness for the mind, did he say that they are also essential, but just be moderate? Please help me to understand correctly. Thank you. Okay, so yeah, this four nutriments. The four nutriments are, as you say, they are the solid food, consciousness, volition, not sense pleasure, but contact is the fourth one. So when we contact the world, you have that is a kind of a nutriment. It is something that helps, that makes you grow, makes you kind of move in a certain direction. Yes, there is, you're quite right, there's a very strong simile in the suttas about how one should regard food, right? And it's only found in this particular place, but the idea is, and this is really for people who are very kind of advanced in the practice, I would say, not kind of just for anyone, but that simile says that when you eat, you should regard the food in the same way as if a couple were traveling with their child in a desert somewhere, and then they ran out of food, and they had the option of either dying all three or to eat their child, right? So they decide, okay, we have no options, either we all die or we eat the child, so they decide to eat the child, right? But you love the child, so how would you feel when you eat the child? You would feel, you would eat absolute minimum just to help you survive, just to kind of carry you through the desert. So it is a very stark story, and that tells you how, according to the story, how you should think about food. You should eat enough to keep you going, but you shouldn't have any desire for it, right? That's kind of the point there. But don't, you know, remember that a lot of the suttas are often taught to people who are very advanced on the Buddhist path. Don't try to emulate the arahants straight away. If you do, you're going to suffer enormously. If you try to be an arahant now, straight away, whoa, you're going to suffer, right? No happiness in life is going to be terrible for you. So be an arahant when you become an arahant. In the meantime, be who you are. Enjoy life. Allow things to kind of go gradually in the right direction. Otherwise, misery, adding dukkha to dukkha, as they say. So understand these things in the right way. Yes, there are the other three, as well, and they are also. I'm not sure if I can remember all the similes now, but there are some similes for these other things, and they are nutriments in the sense that they keep us going, they keep life, make life meaningful, right? Volition is one of those powerful nutriments because we identify it. I am volition. So whenever you use that volition, it makes you feel alive. It makes you feel like somebody. consciousness, obviously a very important nutriment, because experience, right, is one of those important things that we live for, in a sense. And contact is a nutriment in the sense that all our experiences depend on contact as well. Some of the similes here are, I think, for contact, the simile is like a cow that has been skinned, right? The cow is still alive, but it has been, all the skin has been taken off. So that you have this very sensitive kind of, you know, very sensitive skin underneath. All the superficial skin has kind of taken off. And then all the insects come to eat that cow, you know, kind of, you can imagine the kind of the irritation, all these insects and things coming to bite it and eat it, whatever. These are very strong similes, right? And that is, according to this sutta, that is what contact really is like. If you're an arahant, if you are completely peaceful, if you have abandoned all the defilements, everything is gone, then all this impingement on the senses is like this constant irritation, just like a cow without skin is constantly irritated by all the insects and things coming to eat and to kind of to, whatever. You get the idea, I think. That's what sensory contact is like for the, you know, for somebody at that stage. And the volition. Volition is also another very strong simile of what volition is like. But I'm not sure if I can remember it now. Is that the simile with the spears, that you are struck by spears and all that? Unfortunately, I haven't got that sutta with me, so I can't really remember the similes. But there, you can see that this is very high kind of, you know, the way of looking at it, a very high way of looking at things, and a way that really is only possible once you go beyond these things and you don't identify with them anymore, and then you can see them clearly in this way here. Okay, so does that answer your question? Probably not, because I didn't really tell you all that much. Are they essential? Of course, yes. Of course, volition and consciousness are absolutely essential. You can't really be moderate, right? You can't be moderate in consciousness. It doesn't really work. But you just learn to gradually abandon these things, like volition, that the will. Gradually, you abandon it through the meditation practice. And so you learn about it that way. And by gradually abandoning it, you learn that it is dukkha, because when you become more peaceful, actually it's better, right? Less problems. So you learn that the volition actually is problematic. And the same thing essentially, eventually, with consciousness as well. As it fades away, the world, everything is better. And the same thing with the contact. So just keep on meditating, see these things fade away, and then you will understand why they are problematic and why we're trying to abandon them. Okay. Dear Ajahn, reference to compassion. My observation is that the Mahayana tradition is very good at it. Their disciples mouth compassion as they go very big in charity work. On the other hand, the Theravadins have nothing to show, but they are big time in teaching and promoting Dhamma. I infer that is because Buddha's only objective is to teach the way out of suffering. He did not deviate to organize charity. I have never come across suttas where charity is mentioned. Please comment, thank you. Well, charity is mentioned everywhere, right? Charity is generosity. It's chaga, that's all about charity. So charity is very important in the early Buddhist teachings. It's all generosity and that sort of thing is very, very significant. Yes, it's true that in the Mahayana tradition they emphasize generosity a lot, about giving and all these kind of things, and that's of course great. But sometimes it doesn't mean that Theravadins don't give anything here. It's just maybe a different emphasis or whatever. I remember there was once event, some kind of congress, a Buddhist congress or something like that, and Ajahn Brahm was there, and this Mahayana nun was there, quite a famous Mahayana nun, and she said to Ajahn Brahm, she said, "Well, you are much better Bodhisattva than we are, right? And Bodhisattvas are supposed to help other people. That's kind of the mainstay here. So, you know, just because you are Theravadin doesn't mean that you are any less at giving charity or doing good works." It will vary enormously from person to person. But it's not just about giving, it's also about how you give, right? Giving in the right way, with the right intention. And all of these things, are explained in the suttas in quite a bit of detail. So this is also important. Charity is important. How we give is very important. Giving in a way that uplifts you. Giving in a way where you feel that, you know, a sense of compassion towards that cause. You feel it's a good cause to give to. Giving when you feel happy and joyful about it. Giving, of course, to Buddhist causes is great, but give to any cause where you feel it happens naturally. And in this way, you are, you know, doing the right thing here. So there is a lot about charity in the Theravada Buddhism as well. It is true that they are probably bigger when it comes to organized charity work. You have the very famous Tzu Chi Foundation in Taiwan, which does a lot of Buddhist charity work around the world. I don't think there is anything quite comparable in the Theravadan world. So yes, the Buddha's objective is to teach the way out of suffering. It is not necessarily to organize charity as such, that's true. But remember, the two things are not really different. They're not kind of contradictory. Either you organize charity or you teach the way out of suffering. Very often they come together. And a person who is good at charity is also a person who has much better chance of getting out of suffering. You have to learn to let go of your self-interest. You have to learn to be motivated by compassion for others, right? And when you come from that pure, selfless act of giving to others just because it feels good, just because it is an equipment of your own mind, just because it is something that brings you forward on the path, it's a very selfless kind of giving. That is the kind of mind that has the potential to gain deep samadhi. That's the mind that has the potential to gain insight. So these things are not different. They're basically the same thing. So don't think of it as kind of they're not really separate roots at all. We just have to integrate it into a good way, and then it kind of works out properly here. So do as much charity as you possibly can. Be wise about it, of course. Don't kind of give away everything. Give away what you can afford, and then think about how to give in such a way that it inspires you, right? Where do you feel inspired to give? It's wonderful to give to Buddhist causes, but sometimes give to non-Buddhist causes as well. Wherever there's a need, wherever you feel your mind inclines, right, is a good place to give. Okay. So I hope that helps. And we move on to the next one. Dear Ajahn, thank you for your gift of the Dhamma. My new investment is generating super profit. Well, that's the way to go. Okay, good. So you're going to invest differently from now on. Please advise on how to maintain a happy Buddhist married life, like Dhamma friends, for example, sharing Dhamma knowledge, etc. Okay, happy Buddhist married life, right? Okay, well, it's good. You just have to do all the right things, right? Treat your partner, treat your wife, or treat your husband in a kind way, with compassion, with sympathy. Say nice things, say kind things, do kind acts, right? And if you do that, if you treat each other with metta and kindness, then I think it's great. And sometimes, you know, may also be a good thing to do is sometimes have a little bit of time away from each other. So, you know, either the wife goes on a retreat or the husband goes on a retreat. Sometimes that can kind of be good as well, to get that bit of distance. As they say, absence makes the heart grow fonder, right? Too much time together can sometimes have a negative effect as well. But basically, it is all about just practicing these things in daily life. And I think in married life, it can be quite powerful, because one of the problems of married life, you've been married for a very long time, it's easy to take each other for granted, right? You fall into bad habits, and sometimes you say certain things in response to other things, and you kind of fall into these bad habits. So if you can avoid falling into bad habits, and you can kind of always, almost always, not absolutely always, but often do the right thing, say the right thing, think the right thought about your husband or wife, then wow, you're doing really, really well already in the married life. Give each other space, right? If you want to meditate or whatever, then you give each other that room. You have enough independence from each other. You don't kind of become completely dependent on each other. You have enough independence to give each other that room to practice in slightly different ways, or together if you want, or whatever. So this is a great way of being Dhamma friends. So I think that's really what it is. Sharing Dhamma knowledge, of course, is great. If you want to discuss Dhamma together, it's wonderful. But, you know, it's also, sometimes it may be one partner prefers, enjoys discussions more than the other one, so then you kind of have to find a balance there as well. So, basically, yeah, do the right thing and she'll be right. Okay. So, dear Ajahn, yesterday you mentioned give a good send-off to your loved one when they pass away. What is a good send-off? Okay, keep the body in an expensive casket. that is really important one, so make sure you buy the most expensive casket available. Have a religious ceremony. Have a fantastic party with all sorts of cakes, food, while attendants indulge in talking, footy or cricket. Give the body for organ donation. Give a dana to the sangha and give marriage to the deceased. Yes, I think you got the point there already. So I think you know what. I would never recommend anybody to buy an expensive casket. It seems like a waste of money to me. You're going to burn it up anyway, right? And the person who has died doesn't really care whether they have an expensive casket or not. Sometimes it's a bit like maybe assuaging some guilt feeling, perhaps, right? At least we're going to buy them an expensive coffin. But in reality, if you practice in the right way, you make sure that you don't have any of that kind of guilt feeling. You don't have any unfinished business, right? This is one of the things about the death contemplation. It reminds you what is important. You feel, well, is there anything I should do that is important? Do I feel free to die now? It's important to feel free to die, so you don't have kind of things that kind of hold you back and make the dying process more complicated and difficult and all kind of things getting in there. So the coffin, make it as simple as possible. You know, just grab a cardboard box or something like that. I'm not sure if the authorities will be too happy with that, but anyway, So, and there was one member of the Buddhist society, he kind of put together his own coffin. And he said that this is where I want to die. So he was kind of sleeping at home in the coffin to get ready for death. Have a religious ceremony. Yeah, so I guess it depends. You can have, it's not necessarily bad to have a little bit of a religious ceremony, right? You can have somebody to kind of give a little bit of a talk, perhaps at the, you know, to send somebody off. It can be a nice way to remind people of what is important when somebody passes away. You can do a little bit of a kind of forgiveness ceremony, that sort of thing is always nice. Sending a bit of metta to the person who's passed away. Just that reminder at that time can be useful. But that isn't necessarily a bad thing. Not kind of purely kind of meaningless religious, but something meaningful that actually has an impact on the person who has died away and also those who are left behind. The fantastic party afterwards, I suggest you can easily dispense with that. Giving the body for donation is great if you can, right? We were talking about the other day about whether sometimes it is dangerous or can be fraught with problems to give a body for donation before it has died, because the person may still have attachments to that body. And that is an area which I'm not entirely sure about. It's a complicated area. I think that the mind starts to leave the body, and of course, as soon as the mind starts to leave the body and is basically detached from it, at that point, you can give the body for donation if you want to. But it's very hard sometimes to know exactly what that point in time is. That makes for complications. So that probably needs a bit more research before we can make any clear decisions on that one. Giving a dana to the sangha is great, right? To do anything which is meritorious, and then say, this is for you, whoever it is who has passed away. Okay, good. Dear Ajahn, today's afternoon talk, you mentioned about even how now humans have discussions with devas. Could you please mention about this? Thank you. What I was thinking of was not so much discussion with devas. What I was thinking of is that, you know, sometimes we read in the suttas and you read about how the devas meet people. Sometimes they have discussions, sometimes they just see each other. There's all kind of things happening here. And I sometimes wondered, why is it that in the suttas these things seem to happen all the time, and now it doesn't seem to happen? What is the explanation for that? One explanation is that those things you read in the suttas aren't really true, right? And that is a very plausible explanation, because when the heavenly beings, when they meet kind of human beings in the suttas, it is always in the narrative part of things, where kind of the story is being built up. It's not actually so much in the word of the Buddha himself. And often those narratives, those stories, they are kind of later additions to the suttas, and not really core aspect of the Buddha's teaching here. And as such, I think often they actually are not very reliable as kind of historical facts or whatever. So there is some truth to that, that those stories may not always be reliable, and you just don't know where they come from. But on the other hand, it is also so, the suttas are so steeped in this kind of worldview, the worldview that there are humans, there are devas, these divine beings, is very much part of that worldview. And obviously there seems to have been some contact between humans and devas. It should happen today as well, right? And how does it happen? And I certainly know of meditators who claim to have seen devas in the meditation practice, right? So this is one way of doing it, and I think it happens in that way. But sometimes you also hear all kind of stories, right? You hear all these weird stories sometimes, people seeing UFOs and that kind of thing. They see strange lights, right? They don't know what it is. They call it a UFO. But what is it really? Most people will say the UFO idea is silly, it can't be UFOs. But so what is it? And I think one thing it might be, occasionally at least, is precisely a deva. The presence of these divine beings would precisely be seen as a light, right? If you have a special sensitivity to these things, you would see them as a light. Sometimes people have these weird ideas about being abducted by aliens, right? And maybe that has something to do with the deva realm as well. I don't know. I'm just guessing. Just kind of, you know, sometimes, of course, people go a bit funny and then they see all kind of weird stuff. But sometimes, apparently, these stories are told by people who are completely normal, completely sane. And then you wonder what actually is going on. So I think the world is often more mysterious than it appears to be. And all of these kind of things may actually be something we can link in with the Buddha's teachings. Okay, here. Dear Ajahn, I was told the Gandhaba is a name associated with the Mahayana concept. Could you please let us know what is the name of the sutra to read more about it? There is not that much to read about Gandhabas, unfortunately. It's not really explained in any great detail. It is mentioned here and there in the suttas, but it's not kind of a very elaborated concept. It's just that the Gandhabas are these divine beings, right, who kind of live a kind of divine existence. I guess they have quite a lot of happiness and etc. But it's in many ways quite similar to humans, just a bit more happiness, a bit more longer life, more splendor, more joys, that kind of stuff, but not so different from the human life. And then, of course, the idea also that Gandhaba means the spirit in between lives, going from one life to the next one. So I don't know about the Mahayana tradition. Maybe there is something there. But it also existed in the Vedic tradition, or Vedic tradition, prior to the Buddha. And there was a book which discusses some of the... There's actually several books about this, but the books that discuss the connections between the Vedic use of words and then the Buddhist use of words, and how there's a connection between the two. And I know that there is one book which discusses in particular the word Gandhaba, or Gandharva is the Sanskrit version of that word, and discusses the connection between the two. But it's a book is very hard to get. The name of this book is, what is the name of this book again? It's Buddhist and Vedic Studies is the name of the book. And it's a book that was written a long time ago, so it's not easy to get hold of anymore. And you may not find it very interesting if you read it. Probably very quite scholarly and dry, I suspect. Anyway, so that's not much to say about that one, unfortunately. Dear Venerable Sir, sorry for the confusion last night. I didn't mean to ask you quietly do the sutta sessions. I meant something else, but never mind, just let it go. Okay. Okay, good. So I'm enjoying the sessions and the retreat very much. Thank you, with Metta. Okay, excellent. So we got that sorted out. That's wonderful. And you have a nice goofy smile there as well, which is very, very nice, nicely drawn there. Okay. Okay, dear Ajahn Brahmali, I have thought of a way to address the AMD, Advanced Medical Directive, issue and seek your comment. I would contemplate on the simile of the Saw Sutta as much as I can when I'm still alive. And two, I would tell my family members to send their loving kindness prayers and thoughts to me as soon as I'm certified dead clinically, and wish me a good journey, rebirth, and not to worry about them. That way, my consciousness would leave my body quickly, and my organs would still be useful to the people who need them. Thank you. Okay, good. Yes, good. So I think that's great. I mean, it's one of the nice things about this organ donation, right? It's like the last act of generosity that you do as you're about to pass away. So what a wonderful way it is to actually pass away like that. And now you can take my body, and other people can maybe live longer or whatever. So you're giving life, you're giving happiness, giving all of these things as you're passing away. And of course, that is a very powerful merit at that particular point in life when you need it to move on to somewhere else. It is, it's certainly not something that we should discourage. I think we should encourage it, but we should also encourage a bit more research into the actual effect and how the body relates to the mind at that particular point in time. These things can be found out by research, at least to some extent. Dear Ajahn, the contemplation of death meditation. I missed the end part. What do you do with the most urgent matter which I put aside at the start of the meditation. I missed that. What to do with the most urgent matter? Oh, okay. Which I put aside at the start of it. Okay, I see. Please help. Okay, so the idea at the beginning of the meditation was just to feel if there is anything you feel that has been left undone in your life, if you have any problems with any people, anyone you would like to kind of ask for forgiveness or kind of sort out problems with, right? That is really the idea there. So just feel, and you can feel that, okay, I'm about to die. Am I ready for that? Is there any hindrance, any blockages inside of me, anything I feel should be done? And this is a great way of thinking about life in general, because if you are ready to die at any moment, it means that you will never do anything which actually blocks that process, because you will always remember, I could die at any moment. Right? I could die at any moment. I can't afford to have an argument with somebody. I can't afford to leave people in a bad way, because if I die after that, I will feel terrible, right? And that's kind of the point, avoiding this kind of what sometimes is called unfinished business in kind of psychological circles. You avoid that so that you can die at peace, at ease, feeling you have done your best, you lived a good life, and you haven't left anybody in a bad way. So it's always good to make amends for past problems, right? We all have done some bad things in the past, so make amends. Do what is good, do what is right, and then we can die with a more in an easy way, with a light heart, not a heavy, heavy heart. So I hope that makes sense. Okay. Dear Ajahn, if the main concerns re-animal rights in the modern world is the breeding conditions, suffering and slaughtering of animals for food, is there an implied commandment to be vegetarian associated with the first of the five precepts to abstain from killing living beings? Is there an implied commandment? I don't think there is any such thing as a commandment really in Buddhism, but is there a kind of implied, at least some implication for how we should live our lives in regard to animals? That probably is, yes. Let me just see what you have to say, the rest here. If so, does living a life of pacifism and vegetarianism help with good karma in reaching enlightenment, and why? Okay. I think you're right. In the modern world, there's a lot of lot of suffering in the animal world, a lot of abuse of animals and in really many bad ways. And of course, if you don't eat meat, then at least some animals will be spared that. There will be less animals in the animal farms, etc. Because the number of animals is obviously roughly equivalent to the number of people who eat meat, right? So few less animals would suffer those conditions. But it won't have any massive effect on that industry because you're only one person, but it will have a little bit of effect. So I think it's always a good thing to do. But I think one of the things that people often forget about, and that is, you know, we do these things for a reason. So make sure you do it for the right reason. If you're going to be a vegetarian, do it out of compassion for the animals. Don't do it because you want to convert the whole world to vegetarianism. And I think this is such an important thing. And if you really do it out of compassion for the animals, yes, then it is good karma, right? And it will be an help towards awakening because you are coming from a pure and beautiful motive. But if your idea is more that I'm going to be an animal liberationist kind of person, I mean, there's nothing wrong with that either, but it's very easy to become angry and upset if you are that kind of person because you see all the suffering in the world and you feel helpless and you get out on the talking circuit and you give lectures everywhere about how we should look after the animals. And it's very easy to fall into this trap of becoming like a that becomes the mainstay of your life, and that becomes the most important thing. And you forget that if you're going to have success in meditation practice, the most important thing is actually your state of mind, right? That you are kind and compassionate. The most important thing is not to liberate all animals at the end of the day. And by being kind and compassionate, doing the right thing, I think perhaps you will also be more effective, perhaps, in persuading others to follow the same line. At least they will be persuaded in a good way. And anyway, at the end, in the end, it's much better to have more arahants in the world, right? This is kind of more important than anything else. So if we can move forward on the path, I think there's nothing more urgent than that, as far as I can see. So please be pacifist, please be vegetarian. All of these things are great. But remember, in Buddhism, everything is about motivation. Where are we coming from? Why are we doing it? That is the most important thing. What we do is only secondary. The motivation is the most important thing. So look after that, and then you'll find her. Dear Ajahn, please elaborate. Metta meditation plus Brahma Vihara leads to the fourth jhanas. Thank you very much. Metta meditation is one of the Brahma Viharas, right? So not really plus. Metta meditation is the first of the Brahma Viharas. Then you have the Karuna, then you have the Mudita, then you have the Upeka. Leads to the fourth jhanas. Yes, it can do. You can use the Brahma Viharas to lead to the four jhanas. If you are very skilled with metta meditation, you can. The Buddha's main meditation technique is the mindfulness of breathing. That is the main technique taught in the suttas, but Brahma Viharas can also do that. So just find out for yourself what works best for you. What are you able to do, right? What is natural? How does your mind, where does your mind incline? And if you use that, then whatever is easy for you, then you are also likely to get the best results, including perhaps the jhanas, if you get there. Okay. Dear Ajahn, you mentioned this afternoon that you think people have interaction with devas, but don't recognize them as such. Could you please elaborate? Okay, so people took some interest to that. And these weird little things in the world actually sometimes get interesting here. Dear Ajahn, Buddhism originated in India. King Ashoka adapted various ways to improve and to maintain Buddhism in India and in other countries. However, at present, it's very hard to see Indian Buddhists. What is the cause, Ajahn? Thank you. The cause is that Buddhism declined in India, right? It declined just like everything in the world. Buddhism, too, is unfortunately impermanent, subject to change, subject to cessation eventually. And that is why you need another Buddha arising in the world to be able to restart the disappeared Dhamma. So I think there's many, many reasons why Buddhism started to fade away. Buddhism kind of went through a cycle around the time of Ashoka, when it started to become very powerful, a very powerful force in Indian society. And remember, Indian society at that time was very, very large. It was this massive empire that had been built up by King Ashoka and by his grandfather Chandragupta. They had built up this enormous empire. Actually goes back before that as well. So it was very large, and that was when Buddhism was also very strong, and it was spread out all over India and also beyond, moving on towards China, south to Sri Lanka, and possibly also to present-day Burma, that area, and possibly also a little bit westwards into Iran and those areas. So it was very, very strong, and that strength of Buddhism, and this can be found out historically by reading the inscriptions that exist in India, because the inscriptions tell you if there's lots of Buddhist inscriptions, it means the Buddhism was very strong. If there's lots of Hindu kind of inscriptions, then the Brahmanical Hindu religion was very strong, right? So Buddhism was very strong until around maybe the fifth century AD. So for about 1,000 years or 700-800 years, it was a very powerful force in India. And then it started to decline. And you can see that because the inscriptions start to be more and more Hindu, less and less Buddhist. And one of the things, perhaps, that made it decline, one of the things that started to happen around that time was the building up of a very large educational institution, Nalanda University, the famous ancient university of India. It started to arise. I'm not sure exactly when it was established, but it started to become famous around 5th, 6th, 7th centuries around that time. And it's interesting, you know, these big educational institutions, people think they're establishing something to support Buddhism, but very often they have the opposite effect. Buddhism becomes intellectualized, it becomes all about scholarship and reading books and getting PhDs and all this kind of stuff. It's not a good place to practice. If you live in a massive university with thousands and thousands of students and with heaps and heaps of teachers and colleges and what have you, I don't know, many of you have possibly been to Nalanda, the ancient site of the university in India. And if you go there, you see all these massive brick structures. And what you see there is only a tiny fraction was actually there. There are vast fields outside of there that have still not been dug out. They're waiting for the archaeological excavations to happen. May never happen. So it's this massive, massive area, very, very large area where this Nalanda University was. And that may have been part of the problem, perhaps. And then another part of the problem was that Buddhism itself started to be corrupted. It always happens, right? You get corruptions, you get new ideas coming in, infiltrating into the Buddhist teachings. So Hindu ideas started to infiltrate into Buddhism. You know, you have the tantric things, right? Kind of strange rituals and all kind of weird things that become part of the Buddhist teachings. And it's starting to distort the original message of the Buddha. And starting to say that maybe monasticism isn't really required anymore, right? You can do all kind of stuff and it's still fine according to the path. And if you go to Tibet today, you will see some of that coming together of Hinduism and Buddhism, because the Tibetans, they got their Buddhism from India in around the 10th century or 11th century. It was very late. So that the type of Buddhism we find in Tibet is the type of Buddhism they had in India at that time. And you see a lot of these gods with many arms and all these kind of things, which is basically our Hindu religious symbolism, which have been combined with the Buddhist ideas. So Buddhist teaching itself was really declining, right? As you would expect. And of course, then the final kind of cutting off of Buddhism, it was already very weak. But of course, that happened. It's very well known that it happened with the invasion of the Muslims into India in about the 12th and the 13th centuries when they arrived in India. And they kind of destroyed the vast universities and destroyed the buildings and killed all the monastics and all of these things. But because Buddhism was already very weak, it wasn't really able to withstand that kind of massive onslaught. Whereas Hinduism, of course, survived no problem at all, because that was a majority religion at that time. So, you know, sometimes, you know, you read history books and, and people say that the Muslims were completely responsible for the destruction of Buddhism in India. But I think that is a big oversimplification. There was lots of things happening a long time before that. And Hinduism was kind of regaining its supremacy long before the Muslims started to invade. So it seems from the historical evidence. Okay, so I hope that helps. And dear Ajahn Brahmali, thank you so much for this wonderful sutta retreat. I feel so inspired now. I always thought that suttas were repetitive and would not quite understand them. But now I will start to read the suttas you have been discussing during the retreat with much metta. Okay, wonderful, great, hooray. Excellent. Well, that's always nice to hear, getting some nice feedback. People are enjoying it. Because if people don't enjoy it, it still doesn't matter because I enjoy it anyway, so that's fine. Oops, that's a really good, nice question, very easy one. So we'll put that one to one side. Dear Ajahn, thank you for your inspiring suttas. Have got a lot from them. I also look forward to your Friday night talks. Also, a big thank you to the people doing the CDs, as I don't have a computer or internet access. Now I can listen again to them. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. These are very nice notes to have, people thanking and being appreciative of what is being done. That's always, always very nice. Okay, dear Ajahn Brahmali, Majjhima Nikaya 21, the simile of the saw. When the bandits came with a two-handled saw, is it bad to run away and escape without having any anger towards them? Impossible. It is a very good idea to run away as quickly as you possibly can. I would recommend that, if at all possible. Please run away fast. So if you think there is any chance of you being cut apart by two-handed sword, get in training now so you can run really fast when it actually happens. Now, yet that's a very, very good point, of course. It does not mean, and this is one thing, we should not kind of be passive in Buddhism and just say, okay, do whatever you like. That is not really the Buddhist way either. And anyway, these people are getting a lot of bad karma, right? You don't want to encourage them in kind of chopping you apart with a two-hand saw. So, indeed, that's a very good point. The chances of that actually happening is virtually zero. It is just meant as a simile. It is not, I don't think it's meant as a very realistic example of what might actually happen here. Okay. Dear Ajahn, it's perhaps easy to see how wishing others well makes us feel good, as in the metta meditation. But how does it benefit those who we send metta to? How do they receive the metta that we send? That is a good question, and people have different opinions about this. Some people say you can receive the metta that you send. Some people say you can't. One of the things that I would always recommend you to do, if you are sending metta to somebody, then tell them that you are doing so. Because if you tell them, then at the very least, there will be the placebo effect, which will have an effect on them, right? Placebo effect is a very powerful medical effect, whereby if you think that you are doing something, somebody's doing something good for you, it has an effect on your body. You know, kind of famous experiments with the pills, right? There's a pill which has medicine in it, other pill is just a sugar pill, and you give people the sugar pill, and they still get better even by just eating the sugar pill. Huh? That is the placebo effect. So anything you do for somebody will have a beneficial effect for them. So tell them, right, I'm chanting for you, I'm sending you metta. Oh, wow, that is so kind. And then they get better already. Huh? But of course, the question here is a bit obviously more than that. It is there any benefit beyond the placebo effect? And that is it's very hard to know. I think it is quite possible that there is. We live in a universe, as far as I'm concerned, which is much more mental than perhaps is accepted in the present day in science. That's just my personal feeling about the matter. And in a universe which is more mental, when mind perhaps is really the fundamental thing and matter is secondary, that's one possible way of looking at it. Of course, new avenues open up for interaction between minds and all these kind of things. If we are just the product of material phenomena in the world, then that is much more difficult to understand how these things can happen. So I think it is quite possible. but I can't be absolutely sure. It's very difficult to know these things for absolutely sure. Really, you would have to do some experiment, double blind experiment, that kind of stuff, and then find out whether these things actually work or not. But I'm certainly open to the idea. The idea is really that we live in a more mental universe with more mental interaction than we probably are aware of, and that is why there can be that sort of effect. Just guessing here, really, but anyway. Dear Ajahn Brahmali, we have heard from Ajahn Plien that he has a superpower mind. A few years ago, Ajahn Plien visited Bodhinyana Monastery a few times. Could you please tell us a few stories about Ajahn Plien? Thank you. Okay. Yes, well, he, you know, there are monks out there with kind of special superpower minds. That's true. And he is one of those. He apparently has lost a little bit of that power in recent times, but anyway, he certainly had it some years ago. And he came to Bodhinyana Monastery, and we said to Ajahn Plien, we are going to build a retreat center over on that land over there, and we need water for that retreat center. Can you help us to find the water? So we went over, and he said, here, so we put an X on the ground, here, put X on the ground, here, put an X on the ground. And he said, if you drill here, you will find water at 10 meters, no, at 30 meters depth, another one at 80, another one at whatever else. So we thought, okay, well, this is very interesting, right? And because the escarpment here and everything is known to be very dry, it's very difficult to actually find water in this escarpment, apparently. So it's very rare. You drill down, it's not that common to actually find water. So we went, we asked the drilling company and said, drill exactly where that X is. Don't go a millimeter to either side, right? This is where it is. So they did that. They drilled. And they got down to 30 meters and they found water. Right? So it was, whoa. It could be by chance. It could be by accident. Who knows? It's impossible to really know. But certainly it looked like he had pointed out the exact spot and that's where the water was. We didn't try the other X's, and we didn't drill any deeper down because the drilling company didn't want to go any further. But there it was. So this is the kind of thing that makes you quite baffled when you see that. Any kind of, you know, you kind of nonplussed, you kind of don't know what to say. And it looks like somebody has actually seen something, you know. That's what it looks like. But I mean, these things are kind of secondary, remember that. It's very easy to be kind of impressed by these supernormal powers, people seeing kind of strange, unusual things, but in the end, they're not that important. What is important is really insight and understanding. That is what actually matters on the Buddhist path. And sometimes those supernormal powers and the insights, they don't always go together. Sometimes it's possible to have supernormal powers and not such deep insight, and other times you have deep insight, but not the supernormal powers. And the classic example in the suttas was Venerable Sariputta, who had the deep understanding, but as it says in one sutta, I can't even see a mud goblin, right? Mud goblin was obviously the most easy thing to see apart from ordinary human beings. I can't even see that. And then he said, but you, Venerable Mahamograna, you can see all this stuff. And then Mahamograna praises him in turn, but you know, you have this profound wisdom. So whatever, it's like you can see there are different propensities of people. So, and that is what matters. The wisdom is what matters, and the depth of meditation is what matters, that you have the jhanas and that kind of thing here. Sometimes Buddhists are too interested in stories. These stories are good fun to hear and all those kind of things. But sometimes that becomes it. All these rumors about who has what and who, you know, who has achieved what kind of things. And that becomes kind of the mainstay. That becomes Buddhism for people sometimes. So it's important to be careful not to go down that track that is going too far here. Okay, last question for tonight. Dear Ajahn Brahmali, when talking about morality, the Buddha recommends to start with one's own person first. I don't like being treated that way, and others also don't like to be treated that way, therefore I shall do that. Maybe this idea to develop metta for oneself first stems from there. Possibly, but I'm not sure if the two are exactly the same. I mean, one thing is to understand if I don't like to be treated this way, I would treat, it's like the golden rule, right, in Christianity and these kind of rules. It's just kind of a commonsensical way of understanding why it is important to be kind to others. I don't want to hear bad things, so I should treat others well. That doesn't really mean that you are treating yourself well. You just use your own experience as a way of understanding. So perhaps, I'm not sure, but anyway, I think it's a very good way of looking at the world, so it kind of helps out. But please remember that in the end, we can discuss whether what is the original to the suttas and what isn't. And in the end, it is really, if you find a technique that works and you are developing your mind, that is really the most important thing here. It's good if it accords with the suttas to a large extent, because the suttas are obviously the gold standard for what is the best way of practice. It's good if it is close to the suttas, but if it isn't 100% or there is, and it works for you and the other method may not work for you, then that is also okay. That's what I think anyway. So other people might say something else. But okay, so there you are. That is all for this evening. So have a nice night again. Enjoy yourself. Tomorrow is the last full day, so the last chance to make the big breakthrough is tomorrow. So let's do the Arahang together.